This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with the former chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party, now a prominent lobbyist, Jim Nickel. Jim Nickel on the election with Mary Landrieu, Bill Cassidy, Rob Manus. It's only 55 days away, and Congressman Cassidy is in the news for comparing Harry Reid, the Senate Democratic leader, to a plantation owner. Also on the show, Jeffrey Sanford, local lawyer, running as a Libertarian for Congress against Steve Scalise, of all people, the new majority whip in the U.S. House of Representatives. Is this a tilting at windmills kind of campaign? We'll talk about it with Jeff Sanford. Also, Daniel Brown. His book is Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics, The Boys in the Boat. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number, and outside the area it's 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online, and you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Our leadoff guest today is Jim Nickel, the former chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party, now a prominent lobbyist, a man who began his political odyssey back in 1986, fresh out of college, helping John Berlinger Bro upset Henson Moore in the U.S. Senate race of that year. And we've got another hot U.S. Senate race, much like that one in many ways, as Congressman Bill Cassidy challenges the three-term incumbent, Mary Loretta Landrieu. Good morning, Jim Nickel.
Good morning, Jim Inkster. And I was thinking, Jim, I know your time on this particular program is limited in dates, and I think it would be extremely valuable at some point to let me guest host and have you as the guest. We could turn the tables. It would be a lot of fun, and I think I've got a number of questions for you. Your listeners have sent me some, so let's see if we can't set that up in the near future.
I'll think about it. I don't like being in the other chair.
I'm aware of that.
All right, but we might work on that. But thank you for thinking of that idea. And William Morgan Cassidy, Dr. William Morgan Cassidy, lives in a million-dollar estate on Dalrymple Drive. He's been taking shots at Mary Loretta Landrieu and her $2 million house in Washington, D.C. Is this an issue?
Oh, I don't know. I think, obviously, a lot of times when you see ads on television, there's a lot of research behind them. So they don't just throw those things up there without knowing whether they have some impact on voters and whether it resonates with voters. So clearly there's a message there that I think Cassidy may think is impactful on Landrieu, maybe the elitist message, something of that nature. But good God, there's so many of them up there. It's hard to distinguish who's running what ads against whom at this point. But I think it's got some impact. It's with a limited number of voters, but it has to have some impact.
Well, yesterday, Congressman Cassidy came under fire for comparing Harry Reid to the plantation owners of yesteryear. And one of those calling for an apology from Congressman Cassidy is none other than Rob Manus, the other prominent Republican in the race, demanding that the congressman, quote, immediately apologize for using a term that is incredibly offensive to many Americans.
Well, I mean, here we go. I think we're going to see some of this in the upcoming debates as well, where Congressman Cassidy is going to be sort of stuck in the middle, and Manus is going to be able to take some shots at him. And I think Manus sees that comment as an opportunity to maybe get some earned media and some free publicity, and he took it and got some. So it wasn't a bad strategy move on his part, and I think we'll see more and more of that. Manus needs as many of these what we call earned media or free media opportunities as he can get, because he doesn't have the money to be on television and on the radio as much as the other two major candidates. So you will see Manus take every opportunity to get these type of shots in, and I anticipate we'll see more of them.
Well, Congressman Cassidy, I don't think meant the malicious intent that some are alleging here,
but
you mentioned debates. He has opted not to participate in debates. He will participate, apparently, in one debate on October 14th, sponsored by Barry Irwin and Cable, and that's it. Landrieu says she'll take part in five, Cassidy's in one, and Manus has been accepting every invitation he can get. But Cassidy is campaigning kind of like John Breaux did when he was against Jim Donilon. He didn't participate in any debates. Bennett Johnston, when he was against David Duke and Ben Baggert, no debates. And Cassidy's acting like he's an incumbent here with a big lead.
Well, I mean, this election, you know, is a lot about a referendum on the president and on other things, and Cassidy's strategy is not a bad strategy to the extent that he can avoid being attacked from the left and the right and try to rise above that. That's not a bad campaign strategy. I suspect there'll be pressure from the media and from others for him to participate in more debates, and I would hope he would, because I think it serves the voters to have as many debates as possible with the major candidates. But I understand the strategy. We'll see if it works.
Here's a chance, though, for William Morgan Cassidy to confront Mary Loretta Landrieu face-to-face, and he's opting not to do it. And she's saying, bring it on.
Well, I think Senator Landrieu loves a debate. There's no question she's a very good debater and a very tough fighter at the microphone, and I don't blame Cassidy for wanting to maybe avoid such a confrontation, but the reality is if you're running for the U.S. Senate, you ought to debate, and I think we'll see Cassidy come around to more than one debate. At least I would hope so.
Well, on this plantation remark, State Representative Randall Gaines from LaPlace, a Democrat, says to compare the U.S. Senate to one of the greatest atrocities in our nation's history is not only offensive to every single person who is a descendant of a slave, but to every American with any decency. If a millionaire like Congressman Cassidy can't understand why comparing himself to a slave is wrong, how will he be able to relate to the millions of Louisianians who don't make close to the $200,000 a year that he currently earns? Is that fair?
Oh, sure. Hey, look, it's all fair. I mean, you know, you throw yourself out there to run for the United States Senate, it's all fair. Obviously, the Democrats see a crease there in comparing his income to the income of the average Louisianian, and so they're going to take every chance they can to draw that contrast. And that remark gave them an opportunity to make another contrast. I think Hillary Clinton made a similar comment about maybe the U.S. House at some point. I understand people may have been offended by that remark. I don't think Cassidy meant it in the way that some are interpreting it. He just gave the Democrats an opportunity to draw more contrast, and that happens in campaigns. You say some things, and sometimes they come back to haunt you.
Mm-hmm. I recall when I was writing a column for the Business Report many years ago, I went to every congressional office and asked for the number of African Americans on staff, and both Democrats and Republicans had almost none, with the exception of Bill Jefferson, who was and I think Cleo Fields, who were the only African Americans in Congress at that time in Louisiana. And Congressman Cassidy, I know, has African Americans on staff. Perhaps even a bigger percentage than that of Senator Landrieu. So I don't think he is a no. racist by any means.
No.
But is race a factor in this race?
I don't think race is a factor in this race. I think race is important in Louisiana politics. I mean, I think we see a lot of voting trends and voting history along racial lines, and I think it'll be important for Senator Landrieu to have an African-American community that's excited about the election and wanting to turn out on Election Day. So I don't think we're going to see, at least I don't anticipate that we'll see any highly racial issues, racially charged campaign ads or anything of that nature. But there is always a race, you know, involved in Louisiana.
And in Louisiana, if you are a Democrat, and Mary Landrieu is the last Democrat standing in a statewide office, you have to have a large African-American turnout to win. That's just reality.
That's correct. That's the math. I mean, you need an overall large turnout, and actually what you need is the turnout to be relative. I mean, what you can't have as a Democrat is a white turnout that is 20-30% higher than an African-American turnout. That skews the election results tremendously for Republicans. What is in the interest of Democrats is to have the turnout be relatively close. And that can happen, has happened, and in Landrieu's case, it needs to happen. So it doesn't really matter if the white turnout is 70%, as long as the African-American turnout is 60%. But what you can't have is a 50-70 differential. That's bad news.
297-5633, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Daryl Hunt writes, given the desire of so many Republican candidates for office to make the looming election a referendum on President Obama, what does Jim Nickel think of the declaration by Forbes magazine this week, Forbes, that Obama's track record on the economy has been better than that of Ronald Reagan?
Well, it is ironic. I mean, certainly when you look at the stock market and you look at housing starts and you look at unemployment and you look at retail sales and you look at consumer confidence, I mean, across the board, all the numbers are up, and they're way up since he was elected. And look, he doesn't get all the credit, but he certainly would get all the blame if it weren't the case. And so, yeah, I think it's very ironic that if you speak to people, particularly in Louisiana and in the oil and gas community, they will tell you that some of their best years in history have been under Democratic administration. So this has been a revitalized economy, and look, if it wasn't, he would get blamed. So if it is, he should get some of the credit.
Now, Mary Landrieu has cozied up to the oil and gas industry, has support of many in that community, and is chair of the Senate Energy Committee, and is currently running a television spot in which she attacks President Obama. Is that smart?
Of course it's smart. I mean, the president's policies, or at least his proposed policies, have been bad for the oil and gas community in Louisiana, and the oil and gas community is a very, very large employer in our state, a very large taxpayer in our state, and something that's important to a lot of people in our state. Families work in the oil and gas community, or they work in a small business who sells something to the oil and gas community. So, of course, it's in her interest. And look, I don't think she's been shy about that. This isn't political. This has been her track record pretty much throughout her career, is to take on any administration that in any way tries to impair the ability of our energy industry to grow in Louisiana. So this isn't, you know, a lot of people say, of course she's doing this because Obama's unpopular, so she's attacking Obama. I don't think Mary Landrieu would be scared to attack any president that had something negative in the way of impacting our oil and gas industry.
And I heard a radio spot for Congressman Cassidy running in the New Orleans area in which he mentions one ally by name, Senator David Bruce Vitter, saying that he and Senator Vitter are going to join together in fight against illegal immigration. Interesting that he is latching so closely to David Vitter, Congressman Cassidy. This is an interesting pairing.
Well, I mean, the Senator Vitter is a very effective political player in Louisiana politics, and he's a United States senator, and to the extent that Congressman Cassidy can get his help, and it's particularly in the conservative wing of the Republican Party with Manus out there, it's a smart move on his part to try to do that. I mean, he needs the Vitter base in order to win, and I suspect they are a little concerned that some of that base may be split between he and Manus, and so, you know, not a bad move on his part to try to rally that core support.
The man who was the former communications director for David Vitter is now the person who's a communications director for Congressman Cassidy, Joel DeGrado. Congressman Cassidy is working like mad to get Senator Vitter is working like mad to get Congressman Cassidy in the Senate with him, and then wants to be governor next year. So, and then if he wins the governorship, he gets to appoint his successor. So here's a man, David Vitter, who's in position, if everything goes according to plan, to win the governorship and have some say on both U.S. Senate seats. Take that, Huey Long. What do you think, Jim Nickel?
Well, look, I mean, you can disagree with Senator Vitter's positions, you can agree with his positions, but it's without a doubt that he is an extremely hardworking political player, and he leaves no stone unturned. And look, if you want to affect policy, you have to be in office. And he gets that, and so he's gonna work hard on behalf of his candidates, and that's the way it goes. That's what John Breaux did for his candidates, and that's what, you know, other politicians do for their friends. And so that's all fair in this game.
You like him?
Do I like who?
Vitter.
Well, sure, I like Senator Vitter. I mean, I like everybody that I work with in politics. I mean, I think
you ever hang out with him? Go out on the town?
I don't hang out with a lot of people other than my wife and some of my close friends.
That's the right answer. 297-5633 is your number. 877-217-5757. A bit more time with Jim Nickel, and then we'll hear from Jeff Sanford, candidate against Steve Scalise, a local lawyer running as a libertarian in the 1st District. Back after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. Frank Barnett is producing, and a bit more time with the former chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party, Jim Nickel, now a prominent lobbyist, and he has both Republicans and Democrats in his stable of clients, and I think you can hear he's a fairly level-headed, open-minded guy, doesn't speak from a partisan viewpoint anymore. But is it hard to shed those old instincts to attack the other side?
Yeah, I guess in a little bit. I mean, it's certainly been an evolving process for me. I mean, having been a partisan, you know, early in my career. But it comes natural. I think it's probably because I work for John Breaux, and Breaux was never really a hard partisan. He did what he needed to do as a member of his party, but on a day-to-day basis, he tried to work with everybody to get things done, and that's always been my style. I mean, I don't try to take any of this stuff personally. It's politics, and ultimately, it's a people business, and it's important that you get along with people and that you're cordial and you're respectful. And if you do those things, it'll work out. So I've evolved.
I think Bro was grooming you to be governor or U.S. senator, and you decided to make money instead, Jim Nickel.
He was always very encouraging about that. You're right. He certainly wanted me to, at different times to run for office, and he was a great mentor and still is a dear friend. But and there are times when I regret I didn't do it, but overall, looking back, I think I made the right decision.
Well, could in today's environment, could a John Breaux-type candidate succeed in Louisiana?
No, it's a great question. You know, I don't know. I would hope that there are people still out there that want to see people come together and work in a bipartisan manner to solve problems. So, yeah, I do. I do think there's still an appeal for that type of candidate in Louisiana. But the edges are getting a little tougher, and the partisanship is getting a little more tougher out there in Louisiana, no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm. 297-5633. The election is 55 days away, and John Breaux's former boss, Edwin Edwards, is running for Congress again. Bob Mann, another protege of Senator Breaux, in a column that ran in the Picayune, said Edwin Edwards is a farce to be reckoned with. Is this a joke, his candidacy, or does the Cajun Prince have a real shot of returning to Capitol Hill?
Oh, I think he has a shot. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, look, this man was successfully elected governor of the state of Louisiana four times. I mean, any time he puts his name on the ballot, he's formidable, and I don't think he goes about these things willy-nilly. I mean, this is like second-guessing, the best quarterback in the NFL or, such a great baseball player. I mean, they know the game. And they know how to play the game, and they've been successful at the game. And Governor Edwards is an old pro. Whether he wins or not, it's a tough district. I think he would admit it's a tough district for a Democrat. But I think you got to always acknowledge his abilities. I mean, I've heard him on your show. He's very much aware of the issues. I think he's pretty smart to be talking about traffic, and I think he's somebody folks better reckon with, and I think his opponents in that race do. I don't think they underestimate Edwin Edwards.
Doug on Highland. Hi, Doug. You're on with Jim.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for the good discussion. You know, there's partisanship, and then there's also reality and the lack of reality in a lot of what folks hear. I just wanted to throw out one thing that's an issue in the election. The Affordable Care Act was designed to pay for itself, and it is doing that. If you repeal it, it adds to the deficit. If it carries itself out, it reduces the deficit, reduces it by a couple hundred billion. If you repeal it, it increases it by somewhat over $100 billion. So people are thinking and being told that it's a huge drain. It's not true, but it's been repeated so often. So partisanship is one thing, but shows like this are one of the few places we get to actually discuss the reality of what's happening.
All right. I think we lost Jim, so let's get him back, Frank. But Doug on Highland makes some cogent remarks. Read an email from J.R. Madden, who says, I presume some folks in the U.S. have associated the word plantation with slavery. However, there were plantations before established slavery, the Plymouth Plantation. There are plantations today raising tea, coffee, rubber, and other cash crops. And I can't read Congressman Cassidy's mind, but I suspect he was referring to the plantation of old. And Harry Reid, by the way, who's the leader of the Senate, is not the most liberal guy in the House. Back in 1993, when Bill Clinton, without a single Republican vote, coaxed Congress into accepting the deficit reduction plan that revitalized the American economy and caused a boom like we haven't seen in modern time, he got no Republican votes, and in the Senate, he lost six Democrats, including Bennett Johnston, who voted against him. Bro voted for him, by the way. But one of those who voted against the Clinton deficit reduction plan in 1993 was none other than Harry Reid. Jim Nichols, shame on Harry Reid for being the being a conservative who stood in the way of progress back in 1993 under William Jefferson Clinton.
Well, I suspect Mr. Reid has evolved just like I have. I mean, that politics is a constant world of change, and you have to adapt to what the latest issues are. So,
well, and that there's an example. Bennett Johnston, who never ran again, by the way, it wasn't like he was protecting his seat. He voted no, and John Breaux voted yes on that. I'm sure that was a tough vote for Breaux, but he voted with the president.
Well, he and Bill Clinton were dear friends, and I think any time that the president really, really needed John Breaux, he was going to try to be there for him, and I think he wanted him to have a successful presidency, and that's why he probably voted that way.
And Breaux, of course, ran again and won again and ultimately voted for a plan to basically undo the Clinton economic resurgence under George Bush, as did Mary Landrieu. Some would say a poor vote by both Senator Breaux and Senator Landrieu to vote for the Bush tax plan, which sent the country into a tailspin economically.
Some would. I don't recall the circumstances at the time, but I think you've seen in history Louisiana senators try to work with the incumbent president, regardless of party, to try to help him succeed. And when a president rolls out a pretty significant policy, they do their best to work with him. And sometimes it's in history, it wasn't maybe the right vote or the wrong vote. I don't know. But that's what you try to do as a senator, I think, is you try to work with the president, regardless of party, if you think he's doing good things for the country.
All right. Lastly, for Jim, who has places to go and people to see, Marcia asks, how would you characterize Senator Landrieu? Is she a liberal? Is she a conservative? Is she a moderate? What is she?
You know, it's going to sound cliche, but she's a fighter. I've known Mary Landrieu since 1986, and she's tough, I'm going to tell you. I mean, when I was at the Democratic Party, and she was state treasurer, and then when she was a U.S. senator, when she was a candidate for governor, she would call me and let me know how she felt about issues and about things, and she's not shy. And I tell you, I've been to Washington to watch her in these hearings, and she doesn't apologize one bit for championing Louisiana. So I got to tell you, she's a fighter, and she's accomplished some things in the United States Senate that John Breaux and Bennett Johnston could not accomplish, and I think it's because of her tenacity. So, I mean, look, I think she's a moderate by most stretches. Look, in most states, she would be considered a conservative. So I get everybody trying to pigeonhole her into being a certain political player on a certain part of the field, but really, it's really hard to peg Mary Landrieu. Other than that, she is tenacious. And if you want her to be your senator, it's because she doesn't apologize for fighting for Louisiana.
Well, I think she might be characterized as left center, kind of like you, Jim Nichol, and kind of like Bill Cassidy was 10 years ago before he decided he wanted to be a lawmaker, and somewhere along the way, the congressman had an epiphany. He is no longer left center. He is, I think, a staunch conservative, and whether you believe it was for political purposes or not, that's what he is now, and that's what I think he would be if he were elected.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you have to ask him that. I think he's, you know, he's running as a Republican for the United States Senate, and he's going to have to lay out his plan as to what kind of senator he wants to be.
Well, thank you, Jim Nichol.
Thank you.
Let's talk soon. All right, take care. Bye-bye. 297-5633. Jeff Sanford is with us, local lawyer and a libertarian. Extremely articulate man who has decided he's getting in the political arena in a big way, running for Congress. And not running for the 6th District seat, but running against Steve Scalise, the guy who just became the majority whip in the U.S. House of Representatives. Good morning, Jeffrey Sanford.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me on.
Well, why are you doing this?
I'm trying to bring attention to the fact of the votes. Well, several issues, but the main, I think, one I want to focus on, first of all, is the votes against the constitutional rights that the citizens possess in the United States, that we used to possess. As a lawyer, we have joked about losing our Fourth Amendment rights for years. It's hard to win a motion to suppress evidence on the basis of the Fourth Amendment these days. But as I look at the votes of Mr. Scalise, I see that we're losing our First, Second, Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment rights to the federal government bills that he's voted for. So that's pretty much it.
You said Second Amendment as well?
I consider this, if you look at the militarization of the police force, and the fact that all of these police forces all over the nation have, you know, military-style weapons, body armor, tanks, for those of us who believe that the Second Amendment includes a right to oppose government oppression and tyranny, we've lost that right when you talk about having to fight military-style weapons with our what's legal in terms of a right to bear arms. So I consider that to be a infringement on our Second Amendment rights. And you know, if you go into a little bit deeper, I mean, in Jimmy Carter's day, the waist was, I think, a $75 hammer. That was the big thing everybody was complaining about. And today they sell these military weapons. I think Baton Rouge bought 15,000 AR-15s for $1 a piece within the last couple of years, and these tanks for nothing. I mean, where does the federal government get off buying this type of equipment and then distributing it around the United States? So we're not supposed to have standing armies at home. And
all right, but you're blaming all this on the card-carrying conservative Republican Steve Scalise?
Well, I'm just saying his votes in Congress, I'm not blaming it all on him, but he votes with the establishment. We call the establishment, from the libertarian point of view, those in the leadership of the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress. They vote lockstep on these monstrous spending bills, and for some reason they managed to stick in a violation of our Constitution into every one of them.
All right, here's a question from Andrew for Jeff Sanford, libertarian running for Congress in the 1st District. What's your stand on legalization of marijuana and of same-sex marriage?
Okay, and with regard to marijuana, my stance is the same with all drugs. I feel like prohibition, the effects of prohibition are the same with regard to drugs as they were with regard to alcohol, a huge increase in crime and a driving up of profits of this illegal trade. So the way to drastically reduce crime in our community is to legalize these drug substances and regulate their distribution. It would put all the cartels out of business, and it would require people to educate themselves about the proper use of these substances instead of sort of defaulting to it's illegal, so therefore, you know, we don't need to know about it. The government has our back on it. So that's my stance on drugs, repeal prohibition. In regard to gay marriage, I mean, I think the easiest way to say it is the government has no business telling people how they can refer to themselves as married or not married. I think that the government's stance on marriage when it comes to the default rules for alimony, child support, community property are good, but there's no reason why two people of the same sex can't claim to be married. I just don't get that. And another thing is on Steve Scalise, he sponsored an amendment amendment to the Constitution against gay marriage, but also against allowing what's called a civil union, which would be just a contract. So he's gone so far as to say that these people can't even enter into a contract for, you know, civil benefits resulting from their agreement. So that's another thing about Scalise that violates our fundamental freedoms as Americans.
Well, it usually comes down to people's religious beliefs, and Scalise is a Roman Catholic, and probably based on that has some ideas about the morality of same-sex marriage, and it may have infiltrated his politics. And in Louisiana, those politics are perhaps consistent with the electorate, certainly in the first congressional district. So you're running in the most conservative district in Louisiana, Jeffrey Sanford. These ideas you just expressed on legalization of pot and allowing people to marry within their own gender, that's probably not something that is going to fly well in the first district. What's your purpose for running? Is it to win or to make a point?
It's to make a point. It's to make as many points as I can. I'm able to get on this show and talk about, you know, our fundamental freedoms as Americans, and I get on another few other. I have a higher platform from which to speak as a candidate, and my concern is not really gay marriage. I'm not running to protect people's rights to that, but I think that when you talk about fundamental freedoms and constitutional rights, the theory that we learned in law school was that you have to protect everyone's rights. You can't just protect the rights you agree with. You know, a free society must protect the freedoms of all participants. So, yeah, that's what I love about the libertarians. We have a consistent message as opposed to this establishment whose only message seems to be vote for me, and focus on this issue, what I consider a divisive issue, these two that have been brought up. And we'll maintain our hands on the printing presses for money, and they'll be able to continue to spend our grandchildren into oblivion, buying bombs to blow up people on the other side of the world, and to create armies here at home to oppress the people. So
Governor Jindal says President Obama is weak on combating ISIS. Your thoughts about what we should do and whether the governor is right to essentially call the president a wimp?
Oh, he loves to call the president a wimp. I think Jindal, if he had been elected when Obama was elected, would have done the exact same thing Obama did, pretty much lockstep all the way down the line. I don't think there would have been a lick of difference between them. But as far as what you do with ISIS now, okay, you got to look at where ISIS came from, okay, because it appears to me that ISIS came from, was created by, and I've read articles recently that show they're armed with American weapons. I think they came out of Syria, efforts by the establishment to arm Syrian rebels and to arm rebels in Libya, have turned around and have allowed this same group of people we fought war against in Iraq and Afghanistan to become much more organized, much more well-trained and well-equipped to come back into Iraq and really cause a serious threat there. So what do you do at this stage of the game, other than recognize that our failed policies put us in it? I think, you know, if ISIS was to be a direct threat to American interests, and not the people necessarily who go over there, you know, I mean, if you walk into these countries and get yourself kidnapped, I mean, that's somewhat on you, but if it was to become a direct threat to U.S. interests, we would need to do something to them. I think they're bad, but I think we caused them.
297-5633, 877-217-5757. Back in 90 seconds with congressional candidate Jeffrey Sanford, libertarian, here in Baton Rouge, running in the 1st District. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, your number. A few more minutes with Jeffrey Sanford, a candidate for Congress in the 1st District and lawyer in this area who is trying to unseat Steve Scalise, certainly a task that some would say is daunting and perhaps impossible, but you heard Jeff Sanford. He says he's running to make a point, and his point is that he believes, I guess, that both parties are off track in this country right now. Would that be an accurate assessment of where you are?
Yes, sir. Jim, we call it either a duopoly or a one-party system now. I mean, there's no essential difference. They can't agree how to solve any real problems. But what they do is they join together in order to maintain control of this printing press of money. It seems to be their only thing they can agree on is to continue spending these borrowed dollars.
Here's a question from a listener. Who will you support or vote for in the U.S. Senate race?
Brandon McMorris is the Libertarian candidate. I know Brandon. I appreciate Brandon's efforts, and I know that he is a fine man and would make a great senator. That said, my purpose and one of my big purposes is to encourage the growth of a third party, and the Libertarian Party is the most organized in that regard. And not only the third party, but also encourage other people to run for office independent of the two-party system. To me, the key to solving the problems that we have in our federal government and in Congress is for a wave of people to stand up and run for office independent of the two parties. So it really wouldn't matter whether he was a Libertarian or a Green or an independent. The fact is, we don't have an honest debate going on in Congress right now. The only way we're going to get that is if the people recognize somehow, independent of the establishment, and that includes the media and the big money that goes into these political campaigns, that we need to run for office. So that's another purpose of this campaign. And so that's another reason why I support Brandon.
Do you think that Governor Jindal did the right thing by refusing the Medicaid money that is spelled out under the Affordable Care Act?
No. Okay, see, there's a difference for Congress, which is federal government, where I think we should stop spending all this money we don't have and running for governor. If you're governor and your public health care system is dependent on Medicaid money that is still available, and the feds have based their whole health care system on this money being available to the lowest income, poverty-stricken segment of your community, you have to take it and use it. I mean, part of the Libertarian solution is a broad solution. It's not just one thing, but part of it is we have to get out of the federalization of health care and reduce those taxes that go to the federal government so in such drastically huge amounts that we make all of our workers tax slaves. So, but if you could get the tax structure straightened, the feds, we could address the issue with local dollars. But we don't have any local dollars to address health care, and Jindal should have taken the money.
All right. Will Congressman Scalise be debating his opponents? Is there anything scheduled along those lines?
No. Doesn't appear to be. I'm sure there must be a debate somewhere coming. I mean, that's best for me. You know, it's the most fun. While being on your show is a lot of fun, and I appreciate the opportunity. The best is when you can get up there face to face with your opponent and debate the issues. It's a blast. So,
my guess is that he will not debate, just as John Breaux didn't debate Jim Donilon in 1998, didn't debate John Kachakurian in 1992. These people who are incumbents in Washington, they don't debate. Herb Rothschild ran against Henson Moore in 1984. He didn't get a debate. And unfortunately, I'm with you. I think debates are a necessity, and you should debate your opponents no matter who they are and whether they have a real chance or not, but I don't think you're going to get a debate. That would be my guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my guess, too. And that's part of the problem, but the people will see. We had a debate the 6th Congressional District had a debate in Nichols State 2 weeks ago, and there was the 6th Congressional, and then the Senate debate followed it, and the only people that showed up were Manus and Brandon McMorris. And it was a great spirited debate. We loved it. But everybody there gets it. You know, I mean, why would Mary Landrieu, of all people, not go to a debate at Nichols State? If that's not Landrieu country, what is? And so they just, that points out the fact that their concern is not leadership. It's not solutions. It's maintaining power. And once the people understand that, we will stand up and run for these seemingly impossible against impossible odds to beat these people. And we will know who to vote for, know to vote for the independent, know to vote for the third party candidate, because we were down there ourselves trying to watch a debate that no one showed up at.
All right. Well, good luck to you, Jeff Sanford. Thanks for joining us today, and I'm sure we'll talk again.
All right. Thanks so much.
Take care.
Y'all have a great day.
You
yes,
too.
Sir.
Bye-bye. 297-5633, your number. And we're joined now by author Daniel James Brown. He's written two previous nonfiction books and his latest, a bestseller, The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. Out of the depths of the Depression comes the improbable, intimate account of how nine working-class boys from the American West showed the world in the 36 Olympics at Berlin what true grit really meant. Good morning, Daniel Brown.
Good morning. Good morning to you.
How are you riveted to this story enough to write this compelling book?
Boy, I fell into this story right from the beginning. Actually, I walked into my life one day about 6 years ago. One of my neighbors came to me, and she said that she'd been reading one of my earlier books to her father, and her father was in the last couple months of his life living under hospice care at her home. And she asked if I'd come down and meet him. So I went down the next day, and I met this elderly gentleman named Joe Rance. And we talked a little about that earlier book, but then Joe began talking about his experiences as a child growing up during the Depression, and he had this extraordinary story to tell about his personal circumstances and his family circumstances. And that became an important part of the book. But then he went on to talk about how he'd begun to row on the crew at the University of Washington beginning in 1933, and how that had begun to sort of redeem his life, and how ultimately he and his crewmates had wound up rowing for a gold medal, rowing against a German boat in Berlin in 1936 in front of Hitler and all the other top Nazis. And it was just, I just was mesmerized by the time Joe was done talking. And I actually asked him right then and there, I said, "Joe, can I write a book about your life?" And he immediately shook his head and he said, "No, I don't want you to write a book about me." But then he looked down and he looked back up and he said, "But you could write a book about the boat." And by the boat, he meant the whole bunch of them, what they had become together, what they had done together, the whole crew. And it was very important to Joe that the book be about all of them, not just him or not just any one of them. So that's what the next day I started working on it. That's what I set out to do.
And these young men were from the University of Washington.
They were. And most of them counted themselves very lucky to be at the university. Most of them actually needed to stay on crew in order to stay at the university. This was in the middle of the Depression, and none of them had any money. But as long as they were able to stay on the crew, the university would give them a part-time job, and that would allow them to stay in school. So it was a real struggle for all of them.
Did they go to Berlin as favorites in the competition, or was this a David and Goliath type thing?
No, this was pretty much an underdog story all the way. As they say, these kids were farm kids and kids that had grown up in mill towns in the Northwest, and they were pretty rough and tumble. To get to Berlin, they had to beat kids who'd learned to row in prep schools, kids from the Ivy League schools in the East. Then they had to go on and beat what was considered the best crew in the world, a crew composed of kids from Oxford and Cambridge in England. And then finally they had to go on and defeat this hand-picked Nazi crew. So it was pretty much an uphill struggle all the way. And that's really part of the appeal of the story for me, is that these guys just went way beyond what you would have thought they could possibly do.
And Hitler was not pleased with American supremacy in any way, shape, or form, even in 1936.
No, he wasn't. And Hitler was there that day, standing on a balcony, watching, along with all the other top Nazis, actually. It was pretty dramatic, because Germany won the first five rowing events that day, won gold medals, five straight gold medals. So by the time the main event, the eight-oar race, our guys were going to row in. By the time that race came along, the crowd there was whipped into a frenzy. They were chanting Deutschland, 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 and Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil. And so guys paddled out to the start line. It was a very intimidating set of circumstances.
The book is The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. One of the reviews says the Jesse Owens story will always be the big event of the 36 Olympics, but the triumph of the University of Washington's crew team in the same games comes in a close second. Daniel Brown tells the little-known story with verve in an inspirational account. Why has this story not received more attention through the years?
Well, you know, I think it's partly because that summer, that August in 1936, the Jesse Owens story really dominated the coverage back here in the States. If you look at the newspapers from those couple of weeks in August, the Jesse Owens story was just so huge. And, you know, rightly so, it's a great American story. But I think it's sort of eclipsed a lot of other actually great things that happened at those Olympics. And the story of these nine kids in their boat is really, it's just one of the great stories that unfolded there. I often start when I talk about the book by talking about the Jesse Owens story as one of the reasons that we hang on to it, we value, is it's a great story of a great individual achievement. But this story about these kids in this boat, I think it's an equally great story. But it's not a story of great individual achievement. It's a story of a great team achievement. And I think it reminds us that, historically at least, Americans have been pretty good at building great teams and getting great things done. So I think it is right up there and pretty much on a par with the Jesse Owens story in that way.
You have photos in the book that are quite captivating. The Nazis viewing this epic encounter, and when you look at, for example, the Italian team and then the German team, as Hitler would have wanted it, a group of Aryan-looking men in the top in top condition. They obviously were a formidable group.
They were. They had a very good crew. Part of what's interesting about those photos is you'll notice that the German crew are all in these nice, clean, white uniforms with swastikas on the chest. The Americans were given nice uniforms, too, but these were poor kids. They didn't want to get their uniforms dirty, so they actually rode the race in old sweatshirts and T-shirts and track shorts, so they could keep their uniforms nice and clean to take home as souvenirs.
Mm-hmm. How did they compare physically to the Germans?
You know, I think this is really the key to their success. Rowing is a really tough sport. Anybody gets in one of these shells and rows at this level is really, really tough. Don't get me wrong. But one advantage the Americans had is they came from the Northwest up here, where it's cold and dark and rainy and sleety in the winter. And they row all winter up here on Lake Washington, and they did then in 1936, too. These kids, for 3 years, had rowed through bitter cold winters in very, very rough weather and very challenging water. And it was a windy day that day of the gold medal race in Germany, and so they were physically tough in a way that I'm not sure any of the other crews there that day were. They were used to putting up with a great deal of pain and discomfort in order to get what they wanted. And so I think that gave them an edge. I think in that sense they were just tougher than anybody else out on that water that day.
Mm-hmm. The photo of downtown Berlin, 1936, during the Olympics, it is a chilling photograph. People packed so closely together they can hardly breathe, a sea of white faces, of course, and every storefront has a flag with a swastika.
Yep. Yeah, that is a chilling picture. You know, the Nazis, because the 1936 Olympics were intended to be this enormous propaganda coup for them, they turned Berlin almost into a movie set. Everywhere you look in Berlin, there were swastikas and clean, well-scrubbed faces. Before the games, they actually rounded up all the homeless people in Berlin, all the gypsies in Berlin. They took any books that might be controversial out of bookshops. They just literally staged Berlin as if it were a movie set. And it is chilling to see now. You have to remember, in 1936, nobody quite knew what was about to happen in Germany. But looking back now at those pictures and seeing that sea of swastikas, it's very chilling, yes.
And the showdown between the Americans and the Germans in the rowing competition, it's somewhat of a metaphor for what happened 9 years later in the Battle of the Bulge.
Yes. It is indeed. That's, you know, I really wanted people at the end of this book to understand that it wasn't just a boat race. And so I spend a fair amount of time in the book talking about what's going on in Germany while this team is coming together back here in Seattle. Because I wanted people to understand at the conclusion of that race that it really was symbolically a struggle between two very, very, very different views of the world. And as you say, it's a metaphor for this titanic struggle that was just looming right over the horizon. Nobody could quite see it yet.
Daniel James Brown, great book, The Boys in the Boat. Breathtaking, says the Seattle Times. That's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.